Just a quick warning that we're going to be talking about some heavy stuff today, including apocalyptic themes, death, end of relationship dynamics, abusive dynamics, all sorts of stuff like that. So if you're not in the right headspace for that, maybe just skip these next two episodes. Although does not suffice, it's probably not going to get much better, but you know. Also, just as a quick warning, we had some audio issues with this episode. I tried to fix them all, so I'm hoping that they're going to be okay, but just as a heads up, you might want to watch out for that. I'll choose a sparkling ring for every finger I'll put away and hide from view. Hello, sweet listeners, and welcome to another episode of A Hopeless Endeavor, a Joanna Newsom podcast. This is episode 6 on Kingfisher, which is crazy. There's only one more episode after this, so if you are still with us, you are an angel, and thank you for being here. It's just me doing the intro for this episode, unfortunately, right now, because I don't know what happened to the audio for these episodes. The computer developed a mind of its own and like scrambled tracks from like different recordings. It's very weird. I don't know. But I tried my best to go fix the audio for this episode. So I think that it should be okay now, but I am truly deeply sorry if there are any like glitchy, seamy parts or like parts where we abruptly cut off. I tried to like re-edit the whole thing so that that doesn't happen, but who knows? Anyway, I hope you guys enjoy this penultimate episode of Kingfisher, and we'll be back next week with the final episode. You can find all of them up right now on Patreon, as well as the two episodes that we did on Does Not Suffice. So yeah, enjoy you guys. Thank you so much for being here and for listening, and we really appreciate you and think that you're all lovely. Okay, bye.
I have another section I pulled from Christina's Blessing All the Birds article, which again is called Kingfisher Lie with the Lion, Arthurian Threads in Joanna Newsom's Kingfisher Anise. It's in the show notes. So Christina says, in the final section of the song, the narrator makes a case for paganism and accuses her lover of betraying her. With a slowing down and in naming rise above time as it flashing passes, the song enters the bridge. Here, a time slip takes them to their past, the arrival of their pagan ancestors to Atlantis. We came by the boatload, their old pagan ways, worshipping volcanoes, charting the loping skies, and their ultimate demise in the fires that led the city to ash and to sink beneath the waves. The tides of the earth left us bound and calcified, made us obstinate as an obsidian, unmoving save our eyes, something that is symbolically happening at the present time. The narrator finally demands to know whose side her lover is really on. When she sings, to whose authority do you consign your soul? So that's a really cool thing that I haven't looked into, that the ancestors of our characters in this song would have been from Atlantis. Just makes me think of that old Donovan song, Hail Atlantis.
I don't know that song.
Oh, it's a good one. I don't know a lot about Atlantis, and I wish I knew more, because what, like, a fun thing to dive into.
That would seem fun, and it seems like there would be, like, a bunch of East parallels, too, right? Like,
yeah.
We have this, like, flooding island that's, like, super doomed. And I think it feels like so long ago now, but I think that in the East mythology that there is a similar pagan Christian vibe happening, and it's like representing the demise of paganism, and mm-hmm. which is like coded feminine. But yeah, I love that part from Christina's article. Super, super cool. Let's look into Atlantis.
Yeah, I'll spend a few hours Googling that. That's fun. Otherwise, I think the only other notes that I have are like And we've talked about this a bunch in other songs, but the idea that naming something gives it power or brings it to life.
Yeah.
So like our narrator asking to be named or demanding to be named in this instance, I think is really important.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, two things about that are really interesting to me. So like first that, yeah, that the naming has a lot of power in it in and of itself, I think is really, really cool. And then also that you said like, she's standing here and asking to be named, because like, it's like less direct than that in the lyrics, but I think that you're right. Like, she's just saying like, name the one you loved, like whoever that happens to be, I guess it happens to be, but like, presumably the one that he loved is her. So she's asking to be named, which is super cool.
And I wonder if it's asking even, like, it makes me think of like, this is just really morbid, but like in a plane crash, when people, if they have a chance to call the ones they love in those like last seconds, who is it that you choose to call or text or whatever? It seems like a natural response to the end of the world, right? Like, but also like, I get the vibe that it's like, fucking say it.
Yeah.
Like, say that all of this was worth it. Yeah.
That and it meant continue-
something. Yeah, that it meant something, exactly. That all of this, you know, was maybe not worth it, but holds some kind of value in that experience. Yeah. And then there's this, like, weird vibe I get from, in naming Rise Above Time as it flashing passes. Like, it almost seems like this ascension piece, like if you can name the one you loved, if you can stand in like the truth of that, then you can rise above time, like then you can be taken from this the ascension is another Sufjan Stevens thing too, so.
This gives me such strong Divers vibes, that idea that like once you can like once you experience this kind of love, or once you, I guess, can name this kind of love or like identify it as such, then your relationship with time changes. And so, at least in Divers, I mean, we'll get to it, but I get the vibe there that like she, like love is not a symptom, or time is, wait, what? Love is not a symptom of time. Time is just a symptom of love. That, that, like, once you love, like, once you love someone, that, like, time means something different. And, like, in that way, you're rising above time, because it doesn't affect you in the same way as it once did. And, yeah, I don't know. I can't, like, put this into eloquent words, but it gives me really strong Divers vibes. And I think we've talked about Divers shit in this song before, and how like it's at the end of the album, so it's interesting that like we're starting to get Divers themes. I don't remember in what context, but I think I remember having that conversation
in the thread where we asked for help in the Facebook group. David in the Facebook group mentioned how nicely this verse specifically ties into those greater themes in Divers.
Oh,
okay. I don't know. We haven't talked a lot about, maybe it is like you said, just because we're getting close to the end of this album, but maybe we have talked a lot about Divers and I just don't remember. I feel like we haven't.
Like, yeah, I don't know. I truly cannot differentiate like whether these are actual conversations we had or like thoughts that I had alone. Like, don't know. Yeah. Also, I like that there's some ambiguity, at least between two interpretations of like what was happening beneath the drifting ashes. So on the one hand, like the standing and naming beneath the drifting ashes is like what's happening. So like my thought here is that one image is that the apocalypse is happening, like the volcano has erupted, there's drifting ashes all up in the sky. and we're standing below it being like, yeah, looks like we're gonna die. Can you stand here and name the one you love, please? And then on the other interpretation I was thinking of is like the loving happening beneath the drifting ashes. And like the whole time there's been this apocalypse looming, the whole time there's been this like dooming death above them, and the loving has been happening sort of underneath that the whole time with the knowledge that death is coming in one form or another, because that also ties very much into like the diver-y theme that we mentioned before.
Yeah, this idea that in one form or another, like obviously in this song, it's a very violent and like imminent form that death takes. But you're very right that like if it wasn't this, it could just be something else too.
Mm-hmm.
In The Ascension on that album by Sufjan Stevens, one of the verses is... but now it strikes me far too late again that I was asking far too much of everyone around me. And now it strikes me far too late again that I should answer for myself as the ascension falls upon me.
Hmm. I love that guy.
Me too. I shouldn't have looked for revelation. I should have resigned myself to this. I thought I could change the world around me. I thought I could change the world for the best.
When he says, I should have resigned myself to this, I break. Yes. Oh, my God. Should we do the next verse?
Yes. I have 15 more minutes in this room, so let's see what we can do. Maybe someone might not even come right away, but they also might kick me out, get kicked the last people out.
Yeah. Okay. So then she sings, and I think this is the part that Christina was referring to as the bridge, which is a technical term that is helpful for me. Okay, because like it changes in the melody and what it sounds like. Okay, so she sings, we came by the boatload and were immobilized, colon, worshipping volcanoes, charting the loping skies. The tides of the earth left us bound and calcified and made us obstinate as obsidian, unmoving save our eyes, colon, just mooning and blinking from faces marked with coal, open parentheses, ash cooling and shrinking, cracks loud as thunder rolling, close parentheses. I swear I know you. You know me. Where have we met before? Tell me true, colon, to whose authority do you consign your soul? It's a long verse and it's so beautiful and you have to help me with it.
Okay. I mean, I think I'm going to defer to Christina here and say, we came by the boatload, we were immobilized, worshiping volcanoes, charting the loping skies. This idea that we're referencing the pagan ancestors arriving to Atlantis, I think makes a lot of sense. I didn't really, like, the only connection I had to a boatload of something was when Pliny the Elder is going with his, like, army to investigate, like, what's going on with the volcano, and then making it back and immediately dying. I think that's the only other reference I had to that. Yeah, I don't know. Immobilized is such an interesting word to use, too.
It is, to me, such a terrifying word to use. Because the image I have in my head, at least, is, like, the thing that they're immobilized, or, like, why they're immobilized, is because the volcano has erupted. So, like, they're immobilized in that, like, they've burned and, like, perished and, like, are forever. Because, like, we had talked about this at the very beginning, I think, of recording on this song, that, like, a lot of the evidence we have from Pompeii and from the explosion or eruption of Vesuvius is that people are preserved very well in, like, their weird positions. So we have, like, people, like, lying down and cuddling with one another or, like, holding hands, and they're just, like, forever bound to those positions and like in those shapes. And so that's the image that I get, is that like all these people came to worship and then like got killed by the thing that they were worshiping and are forever immobilized. But then later in this verse, they're unmoving, save their eyes, which is like the scariest thing I've ever thought of. Like that their bodies are all immobilized and like burned, but like their eyes are just like moving within their skulls. Like, what is going on?
I really like, I mean, I don't like, but it's an interesting way to think of the relationship throughout this album too, as being immobilized, as being stuck and unmoving. So like, we arrived in this relationship, shit was going bad, but we were frozen in it, like the routine of all of it.
Yeah,
and just, you know, I think it makes sense with how long it took, how long it's taken to, you know, come to this climax. Yeah, but even like that's how Pliny the Elder died too, right? Like he fell on the beach. I don't remember if it was like the... I don't remember exactly how he died, but he just fell over on the beach. Wasn't good. He was immobilized.
He was immobilized. I like the idea too, like referring back to the, or like being explicit about the connection between their relationship and the volcano. I love the idea that like either she might be like alluding to either her or like the two of them worshiping this like volcanic relationship, or like her worshiping this volcanic man, like this guy who's about to like, and like it, this very doomed feeling, right? Where like the relationship was one in which A, there was worship involved, which doesn't sound like a healthy relationship dynamic. You know, it sounds like you're lionizing one of the members or the relationship as a whole. But then also like the idea that like you are worshiping or lionizing like a volcano of a person or of a relationship, mm-hmm. which is like, it's gonna explode. This is all gonna come to like a terrible head and shit's gonna go down. We're gonna get immobilized, but like, yeah, we're doing the worshiping sort of like going on as though that isn't gonna happen. I think it's cool.
It is. And then, you know, if it's interesting to think of like the different things that people worship in general too, right? Like we've talked about paganism, we've talked about the relationship, we've talked about Christianity. I think that ties in really nicely with everything else.
Like here that like as Christina pointed out in her post, I like here that like we're getting some like straight up, I think, pagan imagery, which helps with like my being able to interpret the song. So charting the loping sky. So I looked up loping. Mm-hmm. The definition of it is characterized by long bounding strides. Mm-hmm. So she ran with an easy loping gait, or as a verb, it can be used too. So to run or move with long bounding strides. So we get this image of the sky moving in these like long strides, and then I looked up like charting the skies, and basically like celestial cartography is a thing that pagans used to do a lot. The aspect of astronomy and branch of cartography concerned with mapping stars, galaxies, and I mean all of that really. But we get this like pagan reference, and okay, I don't even know how much to get into on this topic, but I think I was looking up like worshiping volcanoes. Oh yeah, that's another thing that's pagan too, is there's like a whole bunch of different volcanic deities that like pretty much like wherever people live in a place where there are volcanoes, those volcanoes get incorporated into their like cultural mythologies and religions.
Yeah, how could they not, right?
Right, like, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That was like a point that one scholar made, was that like exactly what you said, Sam, like how could they not? Like it would be a really weird thing to ignore given that these were like very powerful impending forces in people's lives. So yeah. There's like a whole bunch of different ones. But the one I read a little bit more about was that in Italy. So Vulcan in ancient Roman religion and myth was the god of fire, including the fire of volcanoes, deserts, metalworking, and the forge. But he's often depicted with a blacksmith's hammer, which I thought might have been interesting, given baby birch stuff. But there's a whole bunch about him. But in sort of looking that up and like looking up worshiping volcanoes as it relates to paganism, I found this like a whole bunch of people wrote articles sort of advocating the same point, and that like the thesis of all these articles is that there's this complicated link in real life in Iceland between volcano eruptions and religion. And so this thesis that like people, like a bunch of people write about, is that basically based on this poem that we found from Iceland a very long time ago, that we can trace this like giant eruption that happened, this giant volcanic eruption that happened, to this like, it maps on exactly with Iceland's switch between paganism to Christianity, which I thought was super interesting, yeah, given Christina's whole thesis in this song. So I'll just read, this is from fizz.org, but it's writing about the influence of this volcanic eruption from paganism to Christianity. And I'll just read it. So it says, memories of the largest lava flood in the history of Iceland recorded in an apocalyptic medieval poem were used to drive the island's conversion to Christianity, new research suggests. A team of scientists and medieval historians has used information contained within ice cores and tree rings to accurately date a massive volcanic eruption which took place soon after the island was first settled. Having dated the eruption, the researchers found that Iceland's most celebrated medieval poem, which describes the end of the pagan gods and the coming of a new singular god, describes the eruption and uses memories of it to stimulate the Christianization of Iceland. The eruption of Eldja in the 10th century is known as a lava flood. This places the eruption squarely within the experience of the first two or three generations of Iceland's settlers. Some of the first wave of migrants to Iceland brought over as children may well have witnessed the eruption. Okay, wait, and then there was like a quote from this poem that I wanted to read. Hang on one second. Yeah, part of the poem describes a terrible eruption with fiery explosions lighting up the sky and the sun obscured by thick clouds of ash and steam. So the poem goes, the sun starts to turn black, land sinks into sea, the bright stars scatter from the sky, steam spurts up with what nourishes life, flame flies high against heaven itself. But anyways, this is all just to say, really cool that there was this link between volcanic eruptions and this switch between paganism to Christianity in like a real life context. There's like real historical evidence of this. But the fucked up thing is, one of the fucked up things is that this research came about in 2018, so like 8 years after Have One On Me came out. So I don't know what to make of any of that.
I mean, what I really like about that is it just kind of drives home the point. Like, if you are someone who believes in nature and you believe in paganism and you believe in stars and the sun and the sky and all of these things, and you arrive to a new place to see that none of these things exist, and instead the sky is black and smoky and awful and you can't breathe. Like, what a fucking shock and like shake to your belief systems that would be, right? Like, especially, like you said, some of these people would have been kids, and like to see everything that you know and everything that you've believed in to be wrong or to be so different. Like, what a mind fuck.
Yeah.
That would be.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, really, like, this like tragic framing of it, where it's like the very thing that you are worshiping, the very thing that you like are devout to, is the thing that ends up killing you, is the very thing that ends up like betraying you almost, you know?
Yeah. It's very apt for like the grand themes of this song. But also makes sense with being immobilized, right? Like, to see that, you would just freeze.
Yeah. Like,
what do you do?
Yeah.
No, that's really interesting. And like, yeah, that research came out after the album is weird.
Confusing.
Yeah.
Okay, should we stop midway through this verse and like just whatever, when we come back, let's just revisit the whole verse?
Yeah, I'm sorry. We should. I see someone waiting outside the door.
Okay, so all right. No worries.
Stop.
Okay, so this is Nikki here with a quick editor's note. We did, in fact, stop recording here, and we only picked up recording like a week later in the middle of this verse. So I'm very sorry about the awkward sort of transition where we, you know, had a week break in between discussing this one verse. And you're going to hear both of us sort of not remember what you've just heard us say. So that's why. So my apologies for any like discontinuities there. And as I said at the beginning of this recording, the audio on this episode is just a bit wonky. But I tried to fix it, so I think it'll be all right. But I'm just going to introduce the stuff that we start talking about here in this little editor's note. So we have a wonderful listener named Katie who sent us a really insightful and brilliant voice memo that we're going to play right here. And then you'll hear Sam and I go on to discuss it after. So here is the brilliant Katie. Thank you so much for this voice memo. You guys should all be like Katie and send us your thoughts and theories or just anything via voice memo, because we love to hear your guys' voices. So that you can send to ahopelessendeavor@gmail.com. But in the meantime, here is Katie with some brilliant thoughts on Kingfisher. Thank you, Katie.
Hi there. This is Katie, and I had a few thoughts on Kingfisher. From the little bit I've read online, it seems like people read the boiling sky and falling ash imagery of Kingfisher as being about Pompeii. And certainly there is that mention of volcanoes. But I've always spotted it as a reference to Dante's Inferno, which I get particularly from the verse toward the end of the song that starts, "We came by the boatload and were immobilized." In Dante's Inferno, all of the souls entering hell get there by crossing the river Acheron. And when Dante himself, the character, crosses that river in the boat, he faints, which reminds me of "were immobilized," because he's a living soul and usually the living are not allowed to enter into hell. Then within the Inferno, there are various circles of punishment according to people's sins in their earthly life. And in the seventh circle are those in the text of the poem who have sinned against God, art, and nature. And they're punished by these flakes of fire falling from the sky, which is kind of a reference to Sodom and Gomorrah from the book of Genesis. And they have to keep running in circles so that the falling flames won't scorch them. And in this circle, Dante runs into one of his former and very beloved teachers, Brunetta Latini. And there's this moment when he recognizes Brunetta Latini. He says, "We met a band of spirits coming towards us, and each one stared at us hard as one is wont to stare at someone in the dark of the new moon." And he comes up to the teacher. When he'd stretched out his arm to me, so fixed my eyes upon his crusted looks that even the charred features could not keep my intellect from recognizing them, and lowering my hand toward his face, I answered, "Sir Brunetto, are you here?" And the same exact moment in a lot of the same language is picked up and referenced by T.S. Eliot, a 20th century poet, in his Four Quartets. And for him, the falling flames are kind of compared to the bombs falling over England in World War II. But in that poem, he says, "I caught the sudden look of some dead master whom I had known, forgotten, half recalled, both one and many, in the brown baked features, the eyes of a familiar compound ghost, both intimate and unidentifiable. So I assumed a double part and cried and heard another's voice cry, 'What? Are you here?' Although we were not. I was still the same, knowing myself, yet being someone other, and he a face still forming, yet the words sufficed to compel the recognition they preceded." And both of those passages from Dante and Eliot remind me so very much of the portion from Kingfisher, where the narrator says, "I swear I know you, you know me, where have we met before?" And obviously the imagery really ties it all together and has always made me think of these two other pieces in connection to Kingfisher. And they also remind me so much with the dark skies and the falling flames or the stars. There's a reference to stars in that portion of Dante, and these shapes in the dark and slowly recognizing faces of the moments in Baby Birch, where the narrator recognizes this face she hasn't seen in a long, long time. And there's the shifting of hair and eye color as if it's sort of a face she doesn't know how to recognize. And one more thing, I think it's worth noting that Dante's encounter with his old teacher, Brunetto Latini, is one of the more positive encounters he has with all of the people he's meeting in hell. He really earnestly expresses to the teacher that he wishes that Brunetto Latini weren't there in hell, that he were back with the living. And Brunetto Latini tells Dante to keep him alive, basically, back in the world, by remembering this book Brunetto Latini has written and taking it to heart. So it's kind of interesting thinking about art and songs and storytelling and everything that's going on this album.
Thank you so much for that, Katie. We are blown away by the references that you brought up here, particularly for me. Like, the Dante stuff is super fucking cool, and I need to read that goddamn book. And also, I remember very vaguely talking about Dante and the Inferno with something to do with Ys, I want to say. And so that just, like, is another parallel between the two things. Was it Rachna on the Facebook group who did that incredible job, Sam, of being like,
"Yes.
This is when you were talking about Chicken Little." Yes. Rachna, you're amazing. Like,
of course it was. Yes. When else is the sky falling?
Fell in bricks of wet smoke. Yes.
Yeah, but I was so proud of Rachna for finding God. That. Because I looked through all my notes. Yes. And we must have just Googled it like mid-recording because I didn't have any record of it.
So if anybody remembers what we were talking about Dante for, just shoot us an email or something. But yeah, Katie, I love that. That's so cool. I think that our first book in our reading club should be Dante's Inferno. If you're down, I don't know. Just because I don't know any other books.
Yeah. oh, we have a list. There's a list going. There's a list. For perfect. Sure.
The T.S. Eliot stuff is fantastic. The Lamb by William Blake that she references, I think, maybe, or if she doesn't. Oops.
It's okay.
Oh, the male person's here.
How dare they?
How dare they? This guy's so nice too. I have a secret.
What's your secret?
It's bad, but when my family was gone and I was here alone, I was using my partner's daughter's car to get around. Yeah. And it's like, he just opened the door. He almost heard my secret. it's a new car. And I just like am used to our car, which has a little alarm on it where like if you back up and you're about to hit something, like an alarm goes off. And this car didn't have that. And so I forgot that like you need to be more diligent. And I backed up into this guy's mail truck. Like I straight up just like backed up right into it, like caused the thing to like whoop. And the guy saw me do it. And I was like, oh, that's just horribly embarrassing. And
did you just say I'm so pregnant?
He pretty much like he finished delivering the mail and he came back out and I was like, I am so sorry. Like, I don't know where my head was at. He's like, it is so fine. He's like, these things are beasts. They can take a beating. Like, it's fine. I was like, okay. Goodbye.
I mean, Aiden would say that's what bumpers are for.
Yeah. So. That's exactly. I did. I hit the bumper. And like on those mail trucks too, it's like a literal like rubber bumper. Like it's a like perfect bumper car bumper.
But Bella's car is okay.
Yes, it's okay, okay. But I was super scared about it not being okay. And I just didn't tell anybody because I'm not responsible.
Man, I was so sure you were going to be like, I ordered like 100 snacks. They're getting dropped off right now. I have to go get the snacks.
I mean, I'm like, that probably did happen at some point. I'm at the point of pregnancy now where I can only snack. Like, meals are too much because there's not enough room.
There's no room. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So snacks are my jam right now.
I mean, snack dinner is the best dinner.
So good, sure. Right? Yes. Yeah. Okay, sorry guys. So
it's a great secret.
Okay, so this William Blake poem called The Lamb goes like this. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Gave thee life and bid thee feed by the stream and o'er the mead. Gave thee clothing of delight, softest clothing, woolly bright. Gave thee such a tender voice, making all the vales rejoice. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Little lamb, I'll tell thee. Little lamb, I'll tell thee. He is called by thy name, for he calls himself a lamb. He is meek and he is mild. He became a little child. I a child and thou a lamb. We are called by his name. Little lamb, God bless thee. Little lamb, God bless thee. So obviously all of the like lamb and child and naming references strike me as super Kingfisher-y.
No, that's great. I had that one in my notes too, probably because of Katie's email. Yeah, I think that's one of the references in the song that's a little bit harder to wrap my mind around. Yeah, still working through that one. Okay, so Katie's voicemail talked about specifically, like just going back to the beginning of the verse, the boatload as referencing the people in Dante's Inferno, the people, we came by the boatload, the people in the Inferno in Dante's telling enter hell by crossing the river Acheron by ferry. When Dante, the character, crosses the river in the boat, he faints because he's a living being and they are not usually allowed into hell. Oh, right. Again, that's from Katie's email. Yeah, and I think the only other reference that I had for that was like in Pliny the Younger's retelling of Pompeii, you know, Pliny the Older takes a boat to another island. He ends up resting there. And then when he comes back to Pompeii, he collapses on the beach and dies. Yeah. So that's, I think, the only other like explanation I have for boatload and immobilized.
The boatload immobilized stuff, it's so hard. I remember someone at some point saying to us that, or maybe this was in Christina's article on Blessing All the Birds. I can't remember. But that pagan people had come, like had migrated, I think, by boat to Pompeii and worshipped volcanoes and then were like fucked over by the very thing that they were worshipping. Mm-hmm. I think that was a thing, but I'm not positive now.
Yeah, I know we talked about it. So in... sorry, I just Googled quickly, like volcano worship.
Yes.
There is the god of fire, metalworking, and the forge.
Is that Vulcan?
Vulcan, yes.
Yeah.
In ancient Roman religion and myth. He's often depicted with a blacksmith's hammer, which obviously makes me think of baby birch.
Yes.
His Greek counterpart is Hephaestus, the god of fire and smithery. In Etruscan religion, he is identified with Cethlins. So I'm sure there's lots there that we could go into detail too, but
I tried looking into this last time, and like I just did like a very brief sort of like Wikipedia survey on like a couple of those gods and just like didn't find anything super obvious.
Okay.
But like, I don't know. I'm sure there's something, but like, yeah, whatever. We need to finish.
Also prescribe meaning to anything too.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, exactly. I think for me, I just took like my personal takeaway from this was just like the worshiping volcanoes and the act of charting the loping skies. By the way, loping, where is this definition? Loping means characterized by long bounding strides. And so super cool to describe the sky that way. It's like, it like makes me think of like a, what do you call it when you like film something for a really long time and then like you speed it up? Time lapse, I think.
Yeah.
It makes me think of like this like time lapse version of the sky, like moving, which like gives you this sort of visual of like the earth rotating or like time.
Is that
Aussie? Time going by, which like in the last verse right before this, she's talking about rising above time as it flashing passes. And I'm just thinking of like loping skies and the passing of time. And anyways, that somebody would be charting the loping skies and worshiping volcanoes. I just took away from that just like sort of a pagan vibe, but I don't know. This could just be me not knowing what to make of it and so trying to attach something to it, which, you know, happens.
Yeah. I had included this post from Cassia in the Facebook group. And Cassia had said, and I forget why I specifically included it in this verse, but I'll read it anyway. Kingfishers dive deep with determination and conviction to find hidden treasure on the riverbed, which is Joanna-esque imagery I see as pushing through the water of difficult emotions with conviction and clarity to find the nugget of wisdom about what one needs in the situation. More generally, they are associated with the gift of perception, seeing things positively and understanding the needs that every situation brings, the courage to face new challenges and opportunities, sidestepping the fear of the unknown, confidence, knowledge, encouragement to leave our comfort zone. In the narrative of Have One On Me, the album, I see this as the major push of courage and clarity that leads to the ending of this relationship. Apparently, Kingfishers also remind us to take close notice of our visions, particularly recurring dreams, as they might be communicating significant hidden messages. And Cassia says, it also makes me think of the kingfisher as a striking omen to pay attention to the message of the horse and no provenance. And I know we talked about that horse forever. I just thought that was a cool inclusion there.
Yeah, super cool. Also, in the very next verse, she talks about the dream. I had a dream you came to me.
Yes. Did we define obstinate and obsidian?
I don't think so. I don't remember having done so, at least.
Okay. So the definition that I have for obstinate is stubbornly refusing to change one's opinion or chosen course of action despite attempts to persuade one to do so. And my note was I wanted to apply this both to the partner, to her narrator, and to the volcano. Mm. Why did I say that? I mean, the volcano, because, you know, it's going to erupt. Like, yeah. Can't do anything about that. I think, too, like, as part of the narrative for this story, the idea that, like, maybe the partner isn't wanting to flee, but our narrator knows that, like, if we're going to survive, we need to get out of here. It's kind of like a last-ditch last-ditch attempt at, like, if we're going to do this, we got to do it now. Yeah. One's opinion or chosen course of action. And also maybe just, like, our narrator steadfastly, like, standing in her decision to end this relationship.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't necessarily call that stubborn, but, like, you know, considering the rest of the album, but...
Yeah. I mean, so the whole sentence, it's the tides of the earth that made us obstinate as obsidian.
Oh, like, and obsidian is volcanic rock.
Right. So if I'm just looking at a similar definition to obstinate, which is of an unwelcome phenomenon or situation, very difficult to change or overcome. And I'm wondering, like, if it's another just, like, real gruesome way of describing that they're, like, stuck in place. Like,
yeah,
which also, like, obviously has metaphorical import. Like, just being so bound and calcified to, like, either the way that they each are, like, in their personalities or, like, maybe what they want. Or even, like, I don't know, you know, like, in a relationship, you can get stuck in this pattern with somebody else. Like, you can just get stuck in this, like, way of being and relating to the other person. I don't know. This is all super speculative, but it's fun to theorize about.
Yeah, no, I like that, especially within the context of the rest of the album, because, you know, our narrator did try throughout the entire album to change herself, to change the partner, to adapt to whatever the relationship looked like in the moment, and, you know, failing this. It didn't work. It hasn't worked. And so I see, like, a stubbornness in, like, continually adapting to something that isn't working, but then also, you know, stepping outside of that and being unwilling to adapt anymore.
Right.
It's just a ridiculous line, too, obstinate as obsidian.
I love it so much. It also gives me this, like, I'm such a broken record, but, like, this almost, like, deterministic vibe where, like, she is likening herself and the partner to this, like, nature thing. Like, so she's, like, not, like, she's, like, we're just the same as this rock. Like, we're not, like, special in any way. We're just as sort of stuck in our natures as obsidian is, as this, like, type of rock is, this rock that's, like, deeply affected by a volcano. Or maybe that is, like, constitutive somehow of volcanic shit. Yeah, I don't know.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, especially because I think when you're in a relationship for a long time, you can get stuck in those habits. And in terms of this relationship, those habits are not healthy or happy, right? Like,
right.
Yeah.
And we've talked to before about her just referring to, like, the nature of things. So, like, the nature of man, the nature of woman, the nature of, like, this particular partner, and the nature of this particular woman, the narrator of the story. And, like, you can want to change those things for the sake of the other person, but, like, at the end of the day, it's just, like, your nature. Like, you're unmoving in that, like, you can't. There are some things that are just sort of set in stone in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and set in stone is just, like, a really good synopsis of this little part of the verse here, too. Like, the visual of unmoving save our eyes is one that's real creepy. Yeah. Like, it really does make me think of someone buried alive or, you know, stuck in asphyxiation or something, and just the horror of your eyes looking around and trying to survey and, you know, figure out what's happening in those last moments is like horrifying and awful.
Horrifying.
From faces marked with coal. Yeah. The line mooning made me think of Beth's email too, because Beth mentioned that one of the islands after the eruption took on like a crescent moon shape.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I looked up mooning just because I was like, what does that mean other than to like flash your butt at someone?
Mm-hmm.
And like it could just be like, it could just be that she's like comparing eyes to moons, like being really wide and like taking everything in. But the definition that I found for moon as a verb is to behave or move in a listless and aimless manner, or to act in a dreamily infatuated manner. So like, the example they give is Timothy's mooning over her like a schoolboy, or in the other context, lying in bed eating candy, mooning around. So I'm not sure which.
I've never heard that.
No, me either. Me either. I like it.
I like it too when you use that.
I'm mooning around. Yeah, but I'm not sure. Like, I don't know. The idea that like they're still mooning in this like infatuated way when they're like, when they've been so fucked over by this relationship / the volcano / like whatever the circumstances, the tides of the earth, and they're still just like, oh my god, I'm infatuated. Or maybe, yeah, maybe it's just the aimlessness of being like, well, what do we do now? Where do I look now that there's nothing I can do about this situation?
Excuse me. And maybe it's just like, you know, fight, flight, freeze. What's the other one?
Appease.
Maybe this is the freeze in the reaction to these events, right? Like, I forget which song we were talking about. Like, it must have been Only Skin, where, like, staying in bed was a safe place.
Yeah.
Was it Only Skin?
Must have been.
And, like, leaving that bed meant to have to face the real world outside and like the truth that like this relationship wasn't working. Maybe this is just like a freeze response to all of this destruction around them, and it's easier just to stay like listfully together than it is to kind of make a plan for how the fuck they're gonna get out.
Also, to finish the sentence with the mooning and blinking, so unmoving save our eyes, colon, just mooning and blinking from faces marked with coal. The from word there is a little confusing to me, but it makes me think that she's no longer just talking about, or like she, like it's almost like the perspective changes here. Like instead of like our faces are marked with coal, she's almost saying like the only thing we're getting is mooning and blinking from all these faces that are marked with coal. I don't know. It just seems like a different, like a shift maybe in perspective.
Yeah. I take the next line as just kind of like a visual one too. Ash cooling and shrinking, cracks loud as thunder rolling. It's in brackets. I mean, it makes me think of like the kind of like ascension? Descending of lava down the volcano and then hitting the ocean and that cooling. And I wonder if there's like a noisy reaction to that as well.
I always just assumed that it was like I don't understand any sort of, is it geology, I guess? Like any sort of anything about what's happening with volcanoes. So I just assumed it was some sort of like accurate depiction of what's happening to the ash as like after the explosion, maybe that it cools, and as it cools it shrinks maybe. But I don't know.
Well, if you think of like ash from like a campfire or something, if you know, you're like starting the fire with paper and then you have those things of ash that float and then shrink and fall.
That
and thunder rolling is like, isn't there enough going on here?
Yeah, so I guess the ash is cracking and that crack is loud as thunder.
But yeah.
Yeah. Who knows? Thunder always makes me think of Zeus, but I don't know what to do. I can't get into Zeus right now.
Yeah.
He's too sprawling.
Too sprawling.
Yeah. The "I swear I know you, you know me" part just makes me think of the part in Christina's article on Blessing All the Birds where she talks about, so God forgive me if I get this wrong, but where she talks about, I think, the characters in the myths of Avalon, the two like loving characters, being, I think, an allegory of maybe these other two characters, I want to say in mythology, but like basically there's some sort of idea where like they're sort of fated to be together, and so like they die but are like reborn and like have to come to meet each other and fall in love again, but like they're the same characters just sort of re-embodied in like these different people. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, go read that article, super cool. But it makes me think of that part in her article where like she's, if Christina's right, then it seems like this is like a really good, like really good textual evidence that Joanna might have had that in mind.
That's really cool and just makes me think of like all the different iterations of their relationship throughout the album too.
Yeah.
Like, and the idea that like you either do or don't recognize the one you love. Especially in like incredibly stressful like situations, like the fucking end of the world.
Yeah,
You know, like. No, I like that interpretation. It's also just like the most romantic thing that like, you know, you are destined to be with someone, and whatever version of yourself you are, that you'll find each other again. It's just like very sweet.
It's romantic, but I feel like in the context of this album, it's like almost dark because it's like not an easy time for them, even if they're fated to be together.
Yeah.
God, that's an exhausting, arduous process that they have to go through every time.
Yeah, like, no, it's true. Especially if it's not, if it never works for them, right?
Right.
Like every time you come together, it's just fucked up over and over and over again.
And they're bound to just keep trying it and like,
yeah,
dealing with the massive heartbreak and like, yeah.
The last line of this verse here: "Tell me true, to whose authority do you consign your soul?" I don't get it.
I don't get it either. I remember last time having something to say about the word authority, and that being maybe an indication of something, but I have no memory of what I was thinking, so this is going to be extremely unhelpful to bring up right now.
I'll read from Christina's article again on Blessing All the Birds. Christina says, "In the final section of the song, the narrator makes a case for paganism and accuses her lover of betraying her. With a slowing down and a naming rise above time as it flashing passes, the song enters the bridge. Here, a time slip takes them to their past, the arrival of their pagan ancestors to Atlantis. We came by the boatload, their old pagan ways, worshipping volcanoes, charting the loping skies, and their ultimate demise in the fires that led the city to ash and to sink beneath the waves. The tides of the earth left us bound and calcified and made as obstinate as obsidian, unmoving save our eyes. Something that is symbolically happening at the present time. The narrator finally demands to know whose side her lover is really on. To whose authority do you consign your soul?" Which I think explains it a little nicer than I can.
Me too. I got distracted there because you read it this way and then I was reading the lyrics along with you. And I thought it was "made us obstinate as obsidian," but it's "made as obstinate."
I think you can apply it in the same way, though. The earth left us bound and calcified and made as.
Yeah, okay.
I would still
think that it applies to the us.
Yeah, made us and made as. The tides of the earth either were referring to us or referring to the tides of the earth. So that's a cool interpretation too, because if the tides of the earth are stopping, time is stopping.
Right.
That's also like a cool idea.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
No, it's okay. That's all I have for this verse, honestly.
Yeah, I don't really have anything else either.
Okay, so that does it then for part 6 of Kingfisher. We'll be back next week with part 7, the final part, finally. Oh my God. Thank you so much for being here with us and for sticking through this like never-ending conversation on Kingfisher. We really, really appreciate it. If you're one of the people who have made it this far, kudos to you. Genuinely, I'm so impressed. Hopefully the audio issues weren't too bad for this episode. I really tried my best. Okay, so in the meantime, you can check us out on Patreon. We have early episode releases there and bonus episodes. So Kingfisher Part 7 is already up there, along with the 2 episodes that we recorded on Does Not Suffice. You can check us out on Facebook at A Hopeless Endeavor at Joanna Newsom Podcast. Email us at ahopelessendeavor@gmail.com. Sam does a wonderful job running our Instagram, which is A Hopeless Endeavor Podcast. Do all those things if you want to do them, or don't. That's okay too. Rate and review if you are so inclined. But most importantly, just, I don't know what's most important. Be well. Take care of your hearts. Thank you so much for listening and talking to us and all the things. Okay. Thank you guys. Bye. We'll see you next week, I hope. Okay, bye.